Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to start by walking into a nightmare. I want you to picture a boardroom. High floor, nice view. You know, the expensive table, the alarms are ringing, maybe literally, maybe not. But a crisis is definitely here. A major disruption has hit the business. The pressure is on, the clock is ticking, and the executive team just, well, they just stop.
The dreaded freeze.
Exactly. They don't move. They don't run out of money or people or even options. They run out of the ability to make a decision. They hit what we're calling a decision jam.
And it happens far more often than you'd think. It's that classic deer in the headlights thing, but, you know, at a corporate scale. And that pause, that silence in the room, that is usually where the company actually dies. It's almost never the iceberg itself. It's the debate on the bridge about which lifeboats to launch.
And who launches them and when to even give the order.
Precisely.
That's a scary thought because you always just assume the people at the top know exactly what to do. But that brings us to our focus today, executive contingency planning. And before you tune out thinking this is just about, I don't know, buying flood insurance or putting a backup generator out back.
Yeah.
Hold on. We're looking at this amazing guide from RSS Inc. called Contingency Planning, Executive Readiness for Operational Disruption. And they define this very decently. They call it preserving control under uncertainty.
That phrase, preserving control, is so important. It really elevates the whole idea from, let's be honest, a checklist on a clipboard that nobody looks at.
Until it's way too late.
Right. It moves it from that to a core executive discipline.
Yeah.
The whole mission of this deep dive is to figure out how leaders can pre-authorize decisions so they don't lock up when things really break. And here's the kicker from the source that really grabbed me. This matters most when a business seems stable.
Okay. We have to unpack that right away. That sounds completely backward. If I'm a CEO and my stock is up, my supply chain's running smoothly, why is that the moment I need to worry?
You would think so, wouldn't you? But the RSS Inc. guide makes this really compelling case. Strong results often mask fragility. I mean, think about it. When a company is growing fast, you're adding complexity every single day. Maybe you're concentrating risk on a few huge clients to keep those numbers looking good. You're optimizing everything for efficiency, not resilience. You're running lean.
So it's like building a taller and taller tower, but on the same foundation. It looks great from the outside, but it's actually getting wobblier.
That's the perfect analogy. And the source makes a really interesting point about how disruptions even arrive these days. We tend to think of them as these single huge events like a fire or something, but in the real world, they usually show up as compounding failures.
Compounding failures. That sounds bad. What does that actually look like?
It's the domino effect. One small thing breaks, maybe a supplier delay. That then stresses another system, so you burn through your inventory buffer. That then stresses your labor force because now everyone's rushing. There's overtime, maybe safety incidents, and suddenly you're in a spiral. So if you're looking at your strong performance as proof that you're resilient, you're missing the point. You'll only find out how fragile you are after the dominoes are already falling.
So success creates this complacency, and that complacency blinds you to the dominoes.
That is the hidden danger of success the guide warns about. You think you're bulletproof right up until the moment you're not.
I want to clarify some terms here, because I feel like I've probably been using them wrong my whole career. The text distinguishes between contingency planning and crisis leadership. To me, those sound like they're pretty much the same thing.
And most people do use them that way. But here's the aha moment from the guide. Crisis leadership is about presence. It's communication, it's adaptation, it's being in the room during the fire.
Okay, so that's the real-time reaction. Put out that fire, patch that hole.
Yes. But contingency planning, that defines the boundaries for that leadership. It's done before the fire starts. It's what keeps the whole organization from depending on just one or two people being heroes.
I see. So without the plan, crisis leadership is just improvisation.
It's improvisation with incredibly high stakes. The contingency plan builds the sandbox. It says, okay, if this happens, you're allowed to use these tools, spend this much money, make these calls. Crisis leadership is how you play in that sandbox when things get messy.
That helps a lot. But the guide also separates this from business continuity and disaster recovery. Again, like a lot of jargon. Can we break that down?
Sure. Just think of it like a timeline. Continuity is simply keeping the lights on. Server backups, payroll, that kind of thing. It's mechanical. Recovery is what happens after the failure. Rebuilding the warehouse, restoring the data. Contingency planning is the decision framework that sits in the middle. It's what answers the really hard questions like,
yeah.
Do we shut down completely? Do we try to run at 50%? Do we switch suppliers right now, even if it costs double?
So it's the brain, not just the muscle.
That's a great way to put it. It's the executive logic, preloaded.
Okay, let's get into the mechanics of this. The guide identifies the real enemy of a good response. And it's a phrase that made me cringe because I've lived through it. Consensus seeking under time pressure.
It is the absolute death knell of crisis response. When things go wrong, human nature, especially in a polite corporate culture, is to call a meeting. You get some data, you build a deck, you start an email chain, you try to get everyone to agree.
Let's circle back in 4 hours when we have more data. I can just hear it.
Exactly. But in a disruption, time is the one resource you can't get back. The cost of delay isn't linear, it's exponential. You spend 3 days trying to get consensus, and the damage has already tripled.
So how do you kill that consensus monster? How do you stop the endless meetings and just act?
Triggers.
Triggers. Okay, sounds simple, but I feel like the details here are really important. What makes a good trigger?
A good trigger is a predefined condition that just erases all that executive hesitation. The RSS Inc. guide is very specific. A trigger has to be observable without interpretation and measurable without debate.
So you can't just say, we activate the plan when things look serious?
Absolutely not, because serious is totally subjective. What's serious to the CFO is different from what's serious to the VP of ops. You'll just end up arguing for hours about what the word serious even means.
Give me an example of one that's measurable without debate.
A good trigger is, we activate the contingency plan when production drops below 60% for more than 4 consecutive hours. Mm-hmm. Or, when absenteeism hits 15%, it's a number. It's a fact.
I see. So it's binary. It either happened or it didn't. No opinions.
Exactly. When that trigger gets hit, the debate is over. The plan starts. It completely bypasses our natural optimism bias, that little voice that says, oh, it's just a blip. Let's wait and see. Triggers take away the option to just hope.
But who acts? This gets us to the authority piece. The guide talks about how, without a plan, organizations fall back on informal power structures, which I assume is a nice way of saying office politics.
It's exactly that. The loudest person in the room takes over, or the person who's been there the longest, or worse, everybody just looks at each other, waiting for someone else to make a move.
That's a recipe for chaos.
It is. So a good plan explicitly assigns that authority.
Mm-hmm.
Who has the power to declare the contingency state? Who controls the really tough trade-offs? Like, if we have to choose between paying a critical vendor or making payroll, who makes that call?
Oof. Yeah, you do not want to be debating that one in a group text at 2 a.m.
And who can override standard policy? Normally, you need 3 quotes for a contract. In a crisis, you might need to sign one in 5 minutes. If you don't define who holds that override key ahead of time, the whole system just freezes.
Okay, so we have our definition, our triggers. We know who's in charge. But now we have to actually do something. The guide calls this the binder problem.
Ah. The bane of corporate life, the dusty binder on the shelf.
Don't worry, everyone. We have a plan. It's in the basement, somewhere.
It's funny because it's so true. A lot of companies confuse a documentation exercise with a real plan. They write a 300-page document, get it signed off, and then they shelve it. But a plan isn't a list of risks. It's a list of executable decisions.
What's the test for that? How do I know if my plan is just paper?
The test the source gives is great. Can a decision be executed immediately from this document with no further debate? If the answer is no, it's just paper. If the plan says, source alternative labor, that's just a wish. If the plan says, call this contact at RSS Inc. and activate contract B for 50 skilled electricians, that's a plan.
That is a huge distinction. One's a goal, the other's an instruction. And this brings us to resources. You can't just manage a crisis away with spreadsheets. You need stuff. Money, people.
Exactly. A plan without resources is just a hallucination. And the biggest resource gap that the guide points out is personnel.
This is where the source brings in RSS Inc., not just as the writer, but as a case study, which I thought was fascinating because it takes us from theory to, you know, messy reality. They're not just consultants. The source highlights them as a provider of workforce continuity.
Right. And this is where the rubber really meets the road. Yeah. Let's say you have a labor disruption, a strike, sudden shortage, whatever it is.
The binder can't pack boxes. The binder can't drive the forklift.
That's it. And most executives think, oh, we'll just call a temp agency. But if you run a complex industrial site, you can't just bring in random people. You need skilled labor, safety certifications, and you need them now.
So how does a model like RSS Inc.'s fit into a plan? What's different about them?
They specialize in the rapid mobilization of skilled labor, and this is the really critical part, supervisory leadership. They don't just send you bodies, they provide a command structure that integrates with your team.
Why is that command structure so important?
Because in a crisis, your own managers are probably stretched to their absolute limit. You don't have the time or energy to train and supervise 50 new people. You need a partner who can come in and say, "We've got this. Point us to the production line, and we'll manage the output."
And that connects all the way back to pre-authorization. If you wait until the strike starts to go looking for a partner like that,
you're dead. The negotiation alone takes weeks. The crisis moves in hours. You need that relationship vetted, signed, and just waiting for the trigger. It turns a potentially catastrophic failure into a manageable operational problem.
It's like having a spare tire. You don't go shopping for one on the side of the highway in the rain. It's already in the trunk.
Yes, but in this case, the spare tire also knows how to install itself.
Even better. Okay, let's zoom out a little. We've got the boots on the ground, but what about the boardroom? Let's talk about governance and communication. The guardrails.
This part is so vital. When you're in crisis mode, your brain shifts to pure survival. You might be tempted to make financial moves that save you today, but kill you next year.
Like selling off a key asset just to make payroll.
Or slashing R&D to preserve cash. The guide says you have to predefine your financial principles. You agree now, while everyone's calm, that in a type A contingency, preserving liquidity is the number one priority over market share.
So you don't have to debate your core strategy in the middle of the fire. You just execute the priority you already agreed on.
It stops the argument before it can even start. It's a pre-decision.
And communication. I feel like fragmented messaging is the sign of every corporate disaster I read about.
It's the classic blunder. You get the VP of sales telling customers everything's fine, while HR is telling employees, prepare for layoffs.
And in that vacuum of information, rumors just explode.
And trust evaporates. The plan has to define who speaks to whom. Internal teams need clear direction. External stakeholders need confidence. You can't improvise this.
I assume the lawyers get a seat at this table, too.
Always. Disruption and legal obligations go hand in hand. Contracts, safety regs, union agreements. The plan has to identify when to engage counsel so you don't make a reactive decision that accidentally triggers a massive lawsuit.
Okay, here's the big question. How do we know if any of this actually works? The guide mentions testing the plan, but it warns against disruption fatigue.
This is a really smart point. If you run massive full-scale drills every month, your team will just burn out. They'll stop taking it seriously.
The boy who cried wolf effect. Oh, it's just another drill.
Exactly. And physical drills, they test muscle memory, but they don't really test decision-making. The source suggests using tabletop discussions.
A tabletop discussion? Is that like Dungeons and Dragons for executives?
In a way, yeah. You get the leadership team in a room, you give them a scenario, it's 8 a.m., our main data center is dark, we think it's ransomware, production has stopped. What do?
And then you just watch them sweat.
You watch them interact. Did they know who had the authority? Did the trigger work? Did they know who to call? You validate the decision pathways, not just the physical mechanics. It becomes a strategy session instead of just a painful drill.
That seems so much more useful, and it probably exposes the gaps really fast.
Instantly. You'll hear someone say, "Wait, I thought you were handling that," and the other person says, "No, I thought it was you." That realization is priceless in a simulation. It's fatal in real life.
Which brings us to the ultimate point here, the strategic angle.
Yes. We tend to think of all this planning as defensive. It's a shield, a cost center.
Right. But the source argues it's actually a strategic advantage.
It's a weapon.
How is a backup plan a weapon?
Speed. Resilience gives you a competitive advantage because you have faster decision cycles. Imagine an industry-wide shock, a supply chain crunch, a pandemic. Something that hits everyone.
Okay, so my competitors and I are all in the same leaky boat.
Yes. But if you have a plan, you aren't panicking. You've already hit your trigger. You've mobilized your support. You are executing.
While my competitors are still trying to schedule that first emergency meeting to figure out who's in charge.
They're deliberating. Yeah. You're doing. In a crisis, speed is everything. If you can make a decision in 2 hours that takes them 2 days, you capture their market share. You win. You can actually come out of the crisis stronger than you went in.
That completely flips the script. It's not about playing it safe. It's about being ready to move while everyone else is frozen.
That's the mindset shift. It's not insurance. It's an execution advantage.
So if we boil this all down for everyone listening,
yeah.
What's the big takeaway?
It means that if you're a leader You have to look at your plans and be brutally honest. Do you have real decision frameworks? Do you have triggers? Or do you just have a list of bad things you hope won't happen?
It's the difference between hoping for the best and preparing to control the worst.
And realizing that control doesn't mean stopping the storm. You can't. It means having a hand on the rudder to steer through it.
And here's where it gets really interesting for me. If you take this to its logical conclusion, a good plan basically automates the executive function during the most critical moments.
It lets the leader step back and be strategic because the operational decisions are already made. That is the goal. It frees up that precious mental bandwidth so you can focus on the long-term horizon, which is where executives should be focused.
So before we wrap, I want to leave our listeners with one last thought. We've talked about the mechanics, triggers, binders, external partners, but think about your own organization right now.
Think about what could happen tomorrow morning.
Right. If a major disruption hits your industry tomorrow, your plan might tell you how to survive. But does it empower you to decide fast enough to overtake the competitors who are still stuck in meetings trying to reach a consensus?
That is the question that separates the survivors from the new market leaders.
A huge thank you to the team at RSS Inc. for the source material on this. It really changed how I look at Plan B.
Absolutely. It's not a backup. It's a blueprint for speed.
Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time.
Stay prepared.